Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Well, there's a lot going on in the world. Iran recently attacked Israel to minimal effect, happily. I think there's one casualty at this point. Anyway, there'll be more to say about that soon enough. I will wait until I can do a proper podcast on the topic of Iran and what to do about it. Today I'm speaking with Cal Newport. Cal is a professor of computer science at Georgetown University, where he is also a founding member of the Center for Digital Ethics. Cal is also a New York Times bestselling author and a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. He also hosts the Deep Questions podcast. And Cal's most recent book is Slow Productivity, The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. And we talk about the book today. We generally discuss information technology and the cult of productivity. We talk about the state of social media, the academic in exile effect, free speech in moderation, the effect of the pandemic on knowledge work, and then we get into his book. We talk about Jane Austen as an example of traditional productivity, managing up in an organization, defragmenting one's work life, doing fewer things, reasonable deadlines, trading money for time, how we will find meaning in a post-scarcity world, the anti-work movement, the effects of artificial intelligence on knowledge work, and other topics. And now I bring you Cal Newport. I am here with Cal Newport. Cal, thanks for joining me again.
Sam, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
So we're going to talk about your new book, Slow Productivity: The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. But before we do, I first have to thank you. I think I must have thanked you by email in the intervening year and a half since we last spoke. But you, as you know, you were the final domino to fall that led me to get off Twitter. And as I've said, really every time I've touched this topic on this podcast and elsewhere, I'm just embarrassed to have discovered what a great life hack that was. I mean, it was diagnostic of how much a problem Twitter had become for me. But I just must thank you for your influence and your wisdom on that front and your actual intervention. I mean, you just straight up told me you thought I should get off Twitter in our podcast, and your voice was definitely in my head when I finally pulled the plug. So thank you.
I mean, you're welcome. I enjoyed and found fascinating the reaction to you leaving Twitter. I don't know if this is how you experienced it, but to me, it's what I imagine it's like when your buddy at the bar stops drinking. Because people got mad that you left Twitter. I can't imagine being mad about someone stopping doing something. But people, it was as if they took it personally, as far as I could tell. Like, what do you mean you're leaving Twitter? What's wrong? I thought that was as instructive as hearing about what your experience has been like after you left.
Yeah, people did get mad. And, from the top down, I mean, Elon Musk was one of the people who got quite mad. It was interesting. I mean, obviously, much of the reaction I didn't see because I was no longer on Twitter, but I got a lot of it in my inbox. You know, many people immediately reached out, worried that I was suffering some kind of mental health crisis. I mean, how do you delete your Twitter account apart from being in extremis? But it's been wholly good and has allowed me to not just pay attention more to things I actually care about, but just it's allowed me to reflect on what my engagement with Twitter had become. And it was, I think people's negative reaction to it is to some degree understandable because my decision really wasn't just for me and my perception of, you know, what Twitter was, you know, had done to my own mind. It is an implicit and even explicit, every time I talk about it, condemnation of what I think social media has done to most people on it. I mean, I think, you know, there's some people who have, fairly benign experiences on these platforms. But for most of the so-called elites, you know, journalists and scientists and public figures who think they are condemned to use this so-called digital town square to maintain their reputations and build their brands and all of that. I mean, it's, and to just stay in touch with what's going on in the world. it has become so dysfunctional. And I don't think this, I can't recall if this came up in our conversation, but one of the reasons why I left was not so much my awareness of what it had done to me, but kind of the obvious evidence of what it was doing to Elon, not as the owner of the platform, but just as its most, you know, most prominent user. And I just saw, it was just kind of staring into the funhouse mirror of his life derangement, which was just quite obviously happening as a result of his addiction to the platform. I then began to reflect on the way in which I was sharing in that symptomology, you know, albeit somewhat differently, but still, once I pulled the plug, it was like I had almost like a digital phantom limb syndrome. And it was analogous to amputating a phantom limb, because I felt that what I was, the pain I was experiencing was happening in a space that wasn't quite real ever. You know, the digital reputation you imagine you're maintaining isn't quite, I mean, it's you can't quite say it's not your reputation. Obviously, it is your reputation, but it is almost a second presence in your mind and life, which doesn't totally map onto your life in real social space with real people in the real world. Even with the same people who you might be fighting with online, when you actually meet them face to face, those conversations are different. And so it was like amputating a phantom limb. And I just can't say enough about what a positive change it's been. It's been quite incredible.
Well, you know, I did some writing about this more recently, and I had you in mind a little bit when I was thinking about this. I wrote this New Yorker essay late last summer, early fall. And one of the big questions I had in there is, why did we come to believe that the right way to use the internet to have discussions, to sort of surface ideas, the spread news, why did we think the right way to do this was to try to get everyone to use the same global platform? And this is, we take this for granted as like, of course, this is what you should do. We should have everyone use the same global conversation platform, because if we're all on the platform, we all can see each other. But of course, the reality, and I sort of laid this out in the article, is when you have 500 million tweets being generated per day, and the average person is going to see 100 in their feed, what you have to do is just incredibly aggressive curation, right? Because there's just, you can't have 500 million people using the same platform and yet have a sort of globalized, centralized, zeitgeisty feed where you're trying to surface a small number of trends for everyone to see. This requires incredible curation, this sort of amazing cybernetic, part algorithm, part human, part network theory powered curation that Twitter uses. And it's, of course, that incredibly aggressive curation that makes this a platform that just fuels outrage, that fuels the darker side of people. And one of the arguments I made in that article is, here's what works better. Small communities that have weak tie connections between them. You have lots of small communities online and they have overlapping membership. We know from network theory, really interesting ideas can spread through these network of networks. Really important news will spread through these network of networks. But most of your interaction in this sort of digital vision is going to be with a small number of other people that have a sort of emergent shared sort of community standard. It's much richer, much more personal. That's really what the internet envisioned. Everyone is going to have the possibility to be connected to everyone else. Not everyone actually needs to be directly connected to everyone else on the same platform. So I've really been thinking about the folly of global conversation platform as one of the key follies of the sort of 2010s internet.
Yeah, I think when we last spoke, you were pretty bearish on the major social media networks, because I think it was because you thought TikTok had successfully disrupted everything because they weren't relying on the social graph that, you know, so you have Facebook and Twitter that had a kind of first mover advantage where they got all of us to build out our social networks in this common space. And that was really that and some, you know, algorithmic gaming of the system was really the basis of surfacing content. And, you know, as we all know, it privileged outrage and you're kind of a negatively biased engagement. But what TikTok did is that it just never even went in the direction of establishing a social graph. It just used a pure algorithmic surfacing of entertainment. And insofar as the the social media platforms have had to emulate TikTok. Maybe Twitter's still an exception here, but certainly Facebook or Instagram. Do you still think that the writing is still on the wall for the major platforms, or do you think they're going to figure out how to still claim the better part of humanity for the rest of our lives?
I still feel strong about that hypothesis. I mean, I think we see, for various reasons, but we see the dethroning of Twitter as having that same central cultural status it had before. TikTok, we see, for example, like my argument was about TikTok is without this entrenched advantage of my social graph is in there. I've already spent years trying to set up follower networks that I said the connection to TikTok would be very superficial and weak. And we are seeing that. I think last year, for example, there was double digit drops in TikTok users among the sort of 20 and especially the upper 20s and in the 30s, that sort of demographic, a sort of young adult demographic said enough. And they really had no problem leaving because what's actually connecting there, it's a very zeitgeisty platform that people can take or leave. I mean, Instagram is holding it there, but I don't think it has that same, again, centrality that it might have had 2 or 3 years ago. And the alternatives, independent media, so podcasting, email newsletters, these really are ascendant in the last year, year and a half since we've talked. And that is that's the opposite of the centralized platform model, because this is independently produced information. People discover these things almost entirely through point-to-point curated trust. Someone I know forwarded me an email newsletter. I signed up. Someone I know told me about this podcast. I started listening to this podcast. They mentioned another podcast. Now I listen to that one. That distributed trust model of curation, as opposed to a centralized algorithmic model, I think really works well. And we're seeing that, right? So I remain bearish on the idea of a small number of social platforms that dominate internet culture.
Yeah, one of the biggest changes for me, which I didn't anticipate, was that shutting down my Twitter account changed my relationship as a producer of content, as somebody with a fairly large platform. It changed my relationship to my own engagement with current events and the world of ideas and just my audience. Like it's just changed the time course of everything. So when you're on Twitter, you feel an obligation to react to something that everyone is reacting to, or at least you have to consider whether or not you should, right? So you're just, something happens in the news and everyone is forwarding a specific article or, dunking on some response to current events. And it's just implicit, you have the platform, you have a massive audience, you're part of this conversation. What are you going to say about it? And no longer having that outlet, the time course of my response to everything has slowed way down. And so, now I have this podcast and I podcast, more or less once a week. And so I really have the better part of a week to decide whether I should say anything about what just happened, in Ukraine or anywhere else. And, most things, I would say 99% of things don't survive that interval, right? Yep. There's no reason for me to react to the thing that happened 4 days ago. And, that has been memory hold for almost everyone at this point. And so it's just changed my relationship to information, to the news, to my own sense of just how I needed to think and talk about things. And I really wasn't anticipating that. There's probably something lost there. I mean, there are moments in public conversation where it's probably an advantage to be able to say something immediately. And, you're part of the first things that are getting said are something you're contributing to. But I don't know, there's so much more noise than signal there. And just the feeling of moving through the day is so different when it's not being punctuated by dozens of interruptions, but with just to see what was said or to decide whether you're going to say something about this next thing that happened. It's just, honestly, it feels like I've just come out of some kind of decade-long flirtation with mental illness. I mean, it's not actually too strong a way to put it. It is a profound relief. I mean, it's a humbling one, really.
Yeah. Do you find it surprising the number, I'm thinking journalists in particular, who very much dislike Elon Musk, right? So they have a sort of moral, personal, ethical commitment to stop using his platform, and they'll still talk about, I don't like what's happening on X. I don't like Elon Musk. And yet almost none of them have left. I find that interesting. I think there's something interesting in that, where it would, for a lot of people who are writing, like in tech journalism, business journalism, really clearly dislike Elon Musk, still can't bring themselves to leaving the platform, which again, I think speaks to something interesting about the way the platform plays, especially people with some sort of public profile, the way it plays and how they understand their influence on the world or their impact. But that's, to me, that's been the more interesting observation of the post-Musk period, is actually how rare you still are, which is, you know, I thought there'd be a lot more Sam Harris's, a lot more people saying, yeah, I'm just leaving. People are having a hard time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do have to recognize that I'm immensely lucky to have already have built my platform in the ways that I've built it, so that I didn't feel that really I was putting anything in jeopardy by just pulling the plug on my social media presence. I mean, I still have a minor presence in the sense that, you know, my team puts out stuff on the various platforms. It's just a sheer marketing, right? So but those were always much smaller accounts. And because everyone knows it's not me, you know, people are much less interested in it. So, you know, I mean, those are just maintained in a perfunctory way. But I think most people who are still building their reputations as writers or journalists, or I mean, certainly people in politics, feel that they just can't forsake the opportunity to build an audience there, and they certainly can't pull the plug on a large audience already built if they're busy, you know, whittling away on their various projects, and they just see no other way to effectively market them. I mean, I just think everyone's been captured by it, and what's more, there is just this sense that if you're not there, you don't know what's actually happening as soon as you need to know it. I mean, especially if you're a journalist. And I mean, the thing is that it's so distorting of priorities and of real information. I mean, I see so many people in the podcast space and in the alternative media space pushed around by misinformation and conspiracy thinking. And even when they're, you know, occasionally right about something, you know, I mean, occasionally there's a conspiracy theory that really turns out to be true. It's just so, everyone's priorities are so upside down, and there's just this, what it has engineered for, this is now kind of outside of mainstream channels. I mean, this wouldn't be true of The New Yorker, where you write, but it's just, you know, out in what I call Podcastistan and Substackistan, it has created this new religion of anti-establishment thinking, where it's just the alternative explanation of everything is the thing that we're now going to spend 90% of our time talking about. And it's just so often wrong and misleading and deranging that, I mean, it has made me increasingly worried that we have, you know, politically, you know, certainly in the aftermath of COVID, rendered ourselves almost ungovernable in how we talk about, you know, attempt to have a conversation about what used to be the world of facts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is one of the more engaging human psychological experiences, is this idea of most people were thinking this, but then me and my group figured out that is true, right? That inversion, the inversion of the whatever, the empiricism structure, is incredibly engaging. And it occurs every once in a while in reality. Like, everyone was thinking this, and then we realized whatever, DNA is a double helix. And it's like amazing. Online culture, especially algorithmic driven online culture, has given a way to basically commodify that and spread that. Like, that we can create, you can build an entire like epistemology around, everyone thinks this is true, but it's really that. You know, everyone thinks this is bad for you, it's good. Everyone thinks like this about this disease, but it's that. Everyone, you know, thinks that. And you can build an entire epistemology around that. Like, your entire world can be that, and there can be a whole audience that's just going to reward that. The algorithm is going to reward that. So I have definitely seen that as well. There's a well-known effect among professors called the sort of academic in exile or academic in the wilds effect, which is if you take an academic and then they leave academia, you know, they go independent, 8 times out of 10, they go to some really conspiratorial places. And partially what's going on here is, well, first of all, they're smart. So like, it completely makes sense to them that I could figure something out that other people didn't understand, because I'm very smart. But one of the purposes and like services academia plays is there's this checking mechanism. Everyone else is smart too. And so when you're like, hey, I think, look, here's this this whole new way of seeing it. The earth is hollow. You have all these other smart people being like, here's why you're dumb. And they take you down, right? But when you leave, you have this academic in exile. And this is sort of like Linus Pauling with vitamin megadosing, mm-hmm. right? It's much, much higher rate now in the age of social media, because now when you leave, you can immediately algorithmically have constructed an audience that cheers you on. Yeah. And so now I think the severity of academic and exile effect is much more pronounced and much more ubiquitous than it used to be. That when you sort of leave academia to start your podcast, it's not too long until, you know, there's world-changing conspiracies that you're uncovering. And it could be medical and it could be governmental and it doesn't matter. And so I think that effect is like one of the more interesting effects that's been happening, is that you can get a cheering section.
Yeah.
And the algorithmically constructed cheering section of people that you're being rewarded for saying, I think this is the way it really happens. And, you know, you see this all the time. I think I like podcastistan as a term. This idea of there can be 100 studies saying something, but if there's one study saying something different, the way you perceive that is, well, everyone knows now that thing's not true. It's this interesting sort of sampling of evidence, this sort of destabilization of Bayesian priors that is amplified and supported in sort of the world of algorithmically discriminated or algorithmically disseminated information.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, this is you just described an effect that I've referred to, I believe previously, as watching people get radicalized by their own audience, right? Yep. I mean, that cheering section has the effect of people notice the signal in their own audience and then they begin to cater to that signal. And then there's just this ratchet effect where it just gets, you know, crazier and crazier, and there's more and more sunk cost reputationally for having been the guy who was sure that there's so many examples of this in the midst of COVID that focus on vaccines and medical conspiracies, et cetera. You go all in, and then you'd have to completely repudiate how you spent the last 12 months if you were going to have a second thought and anyone was going to talk any sense into you.
Yep.
So there's one thing that reliably confuses people here around the norms of our online conversation. And it's the analogy of Twitter being the so-called digital town square, and this notion that a commitment to free speech should more or less bar the door to any kind of, you know, real moderation policy, right? Like what you want is a total free-for-all where the best idea wins and sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? So we should be able to entertain any notion at whatever scale for however long in proximity to any other world events. And any effort to put your thumb on the scale to deplatform Alex Jones or to try to clean up a digital sewer that's introducing bias by definition, and worse, it's actually just a repudiation of, you know, free speech in the constitutional sense, and it's forsaking the best error correcting mechanisms we have, which are just let everything suffer collision with everything else and see what wins, right? And so people never, when they're championing this, you know, commitment to something like free speech absolutism, they never take a moment to recognize that there are places online that are much closer to the absolute than Twitter ever was, and no one wants to be there. I mean, places like 4chan and 8chan, I mean, that's where you really get your absolutes, right? Where you can just, you know, I mean, everything up to child pornography might populate your feed. But there's also just this point that is also overlooked, which you just referenced, which is the algorithmically boosted aspect of the speech, which changes the nature of what speech is online. So perhaps you could just give me your thoughts on how you view this tension between our commitment to free speech, our commitment to leveraging the wisdom of the crowd insofar as it exists and to correcting errors at scale, but this need to not suffer the 4chanification of everything in our digital lives.
Yeah. Well, I think the town square, it's a town square analogy that's causing the problem here, right? I mean, the concept of a town square, the sort of central gathering place where people can democratically discuss depends on scale being reasonable, right? I mean, we call it the town square. We don't call it the city or the state square, right? Because it's a place where the Demos in Athens, we sort of a relatively constrained group of people who all know each other and have other ties to each other. You have other social trust ties to each other. We live in the same town. I run the hardware store that you come to buy your nails. Them to come together, there's this free speech notion of, well, we don't want to, by fiat in advance, say, here are topics that are off limits, because how are we going to work together to advance what we understand? Twitter is not a town square, right? When you have 500 million users, that's not a town square. It's an entertainment product. Hmm. We have 500 million users who are inputting lots of different possible bits of content that could be interesting. We're going to run them through this cybernetic curation algorithm. So what I mean by that is there's algorithms involved, but it's also the expansion properties of the underlying follower graph means that individual decisions to retweet or not retweet. So these are human decisions interacting with these digital networks can create these cascades of information spreading. That's a lot about how trends arise. It's a really powerful actual curation mechanism. It's unlike TikTok, which is purely algorithmic. On Twitter, it's cybernetic. And so you have these digital networks with good expansion properties and, you know, 100 million people making individual decisions whether or not to click retweet or not, whether to quote tweet or not. So that, which is a whole interesting sort of computer science question. All of this aimed towards how can we take this giant pool of potential content and choose the sort of small number of streams of content that are going to be relatively globalized that are interesting and engaging. That's not a town square. It's an entertainment product. It's why in a New Yorker piece I wrote right after Musk took over Twitter, is I said, it's not the town square. It's much more the Colosseum. That's much more the better idea. It's tons of people watching carefully curated entertainment. In that context, of course, you have all sorts of thumbs on the scale. Like the whole point is we're trying to put on this show. And I think of like the trending topics of the day as the show on the Colosseum floor with all the huge crowds just watching and chiming in to see the blood sport between, hey, Sam today is having a war with, you know, whoever, right? This is the entertainment for today. It's an entertainment product. Of course, the thumb is on the scale because you're trying to find something that like just pushes the buttons right. Maybe there's some outrage, but not too much. Maybe it's absurd, but not in a sort of 8chan, like completely over the top, lols type absurd. You're trying to program a television station. You're trying to program entertainment in a Colosseum. It's not a town square. Now, if you have actual digital town squares, like here's a place where like a small number of people who have other ties to each other are gathering to think things through and talk things through. I mean, we've seen examples of those can have a wide variety of different community standards, including standards where like almost anything is going to go on this discussion group, but it works because we're all whatever, lumberjacks from this part of the country, and we sort of have other ties to each other. And so I think it's that town square metaphor that threw us off, is we took this entertainment product and somehow tried to make it seem like this was the Roman Senate. Like this is where just like this reasonable scaled group of people were getting together to hash things out. And that's never what they were actually trying to do there.
It seems reasonable to have made this mistake, though. I mean, the structure you're positing, like a network of networks online, that at least is implied on Twitter because you have the people you're following and you have the people who are following you. And that's not all of Twitter, right? It's just you're just tending to see what you're following, and everyone sees, you know, everyone who's following you sees what you react to. And that's its own little space. Why is that so easily corrupted by being in contact with the rest of the ocean of information?
Well, what ends up happening on Twitter is that more local interactions just get swamped out by the ultra amplified content, right? And increasingly their feed is driven by this. So there's some stuff in there from people you straight follow, but the feed is algorithmically sorted. And one of the major criteria on which things are sorted for your feed is their engagement across the network. So really what's happened is it's the content that has really gained this big boosting effect, this sort of cascade of retweets leading to retweets. That's what's being programmed for. And there's some conceptual regionalization. So if you follow a lot of a certain type of people, you might be seeing what's really being amplified in that subgroup. That's true. There's some of that going on as well. But it's a really large scale at which a lot of this is happening. And especially when it comes to the most town square-y piece of this, which is discussions of politics, discussions of policy, discussions of world events, the sort of the stuff we think of as the grist of civic discussion. those are incredibly large subnetworks in which information is spreading. And that's where you really have the Colosseum effect. It's people competing to get their turn on the Colosseum floor. They have their trident ready. And that's like that most civic-minded aspect that we associate with Twitter, I think, is the most entertainment-centric.
Yeah. And the most corrupting of our conversation about important topics, because one of the thumbs on the scale here is outrage. And I mean, outrage is a word we keep using in this context, and it seems to have been, I mean, at least in my hearing, it doesn't quite convey the attitude that one sees so often online, which is, it really is kind of in-group sanctimony and out-group contempt, right? You're expressing contempt for the out-group to your in-group. It's a simulacrum of conversation. I mean, sometimes you're actually, you know, someone's responding to somebody else, but it's almost always a bad faith response. It's a response that is meant to be enjoyed by the in-group that despises the target of the remark in the out-group. And it's so obviously driving us apart at the level of society. Again, not when you're talking about how beautiful a full solar eclipse is, but, you know, when you're talking about politics or anything that is polarizing.
Yeah. No, and I'm with you on this, right? It does that. And you're auditioning when you comment on someone's tweet. You're auditioning for the algorithm, this sort of cybernetic amplification effect. So everyone tries to one-up each other. I mean, I hear a lot from people, you know, what they're worried about mainly is not the contempt from the other side, but that the in-group policing, I think, has had a massive impact.
Yeah.
You see it in journalism. You see it in academia. You see it in sort of theoretical frameworks. You certainly see it to some degree in politics. Though it's interesting, politicians, they're so used to that. It's almost as if they're the one group that at least sort of understands the sociodynamics of something like Twitter. Like, this is sort of their lives, is, you know, in-group policing, out-group contempt, being okay with, like, these people are upset, who am I going to hitch my wagon to, putting their finger to the wind. But for most other people aren't used to that. And so it's definitely an effect that makes you either cower or makes you conform. Look, I only get some taste of this, like, when I'm doing book tours, right? Because I'm not on social media, so I'm not subject to people talking about me in these sort of contexts. When you have a book out, you get reviews and people come out to talk about your book or whatever. And I hate it. And I couldn't imagine if that was just all the time. If like all the time that was the world I was in, is like every week I have to get like the two or three people that are like taking their swing at me or whatever. I mean, that would drastically affect, I'm sure, what I write about, how I went through my life, just like the subjective well-being. Yes, I was really hoping for Elon to destabilize Twitter so much that it essentially collapsed. Like, that it would actually be like a great civic duty that he would have done. But it seems to be holding on to some degree, at least as far as I can tell, which is, I think, unfortunate.
Yeah, well, he's destabilized something, and it's been his own brain. But it's just, he really is a cautionary tale at this point. And that has always been my concern about his engagement with Twitter, not so much what he was going to do to the platform. For the longest time, I remained agnostic as to whether or not he could actually significantly improve it. Doesn't seem likely to me now, but I'm not really in touch with what it's become. But it's just as for its effect on him, you know, one of the most productive people in any generation, it hasn't been good. Let's turn to your book, because it's really, I mean, you've written a series of books that have targeted the same kind of object here, which is a life well lived, right? I mean, the question is, like, how do we answer the question, what is life good for, right? I mean, the people, especially when you get to a certain level of privilege and abundance and just sheer good luck, and this is almost by definition much of our audience, you know, for a podcast like this or for a book like yours. I mean, we're talking about people who have the time to think about how to improve their lives and how to live more wisely and get to a place where they more and more are not regretting how they use their time. I mean, that does suggest, you know, at least a few degrees of freedom there in the kinds of choices they make. You know, presumably, if you're listening to this podcast, you're not digging a ditch in the sun under the lash of some tyrant, right? So you seem to be, at least implicitly and rather often explicitly, asking these types of questions. You know, just like, what is the point of all of this? What does winning the game actually look like? And in this most recent book, you're talking about a new approach to productivity, which, you know, you say it's a lost art. So you're suggesting that we were once much better at this. So let's just start with your basic concept. What do you mean by slow productivity, and how have we lost touch with it?
Well, I agree with your characterization of the questions I think about. I would add something else to it, which is, you know, as a computer scientist, as a, you know, digital theorist, I care in particular how technology intersects with that story as well, right? So in most of my writing of the last decade, there's usually a unintended consequence of a technological development that gets us out of touch or becomes an obstacle to living some life that's going to be deeper, more meaningful. And we have to grapple with that and understand that technology, the opportunities, the perils, and sort of navigate around it, right? So even this book, like Slow Productivity, the problem that I'm solving, there's actually a techno story behind it, right? I mean, so there's an easier way of summarizing it, which is, look, there's a key question that a lot of people are in, mainly, as you say, the sort of knowledge work world. These are people who are doing pretty well, right? You have a job in which you look at a computer screen and you're an air conditioner, right? So a lucky place to be. But that group of people, and these are the people, these are a big group of my readers, a big question a lot of them have is, okay, how do I do my work well? How do I produce things I'm proud of, have impact, you know, support my family, and yet not let work just take over all of my life? How do I avoid sort of falling into burnout? I don't want to be like pre-Twitter Elon Musk and just don't sleep and have seven businesses and just get after it. Like, how do I still do stuff I'm proud of, but also spend time with my kids, right? There's this big question. And the book looks at that question from both the perspective of someone like creatives that have a huge amount of autonomy, and also from the perspective of sort of a standard office worker who has less autonomy. How can they still sort of navigate that knife's edge? But there's a techno story behind how we got to a place where that question became more and more relevant. And the story that I'm trying to tell in the first part of the book is knowledge work itself, when that emerged as a major sector, which is really like mid-20th century, had this issue of not really knowing how to define productivity. Because we had industrial productivity was a quantitative concept. It's a ratio, it's Model T's per paid labor hour. Agricultural productivity is a quantitative idea. It's bushels of corn per acre of land. You could measure this. Industrial manufacturing, agriculture, you had well-defined production systems. So you could tweak something very specific and see how it impacted that number. Knowledge work comes along under that works. Knowledge work is more haphazard and autonomous and ambiguous. I might be working on seven things that are different than the eight things you're working on. There's not one thing we're producing. There's no well-defined production systems we use for our work as well. Organizing labor is very independent and individualized in knowledge work. And so in response to that, the knowledge sector came up with this idea of, we will use visible activity as a proxy for you doing something useful. So we'll all gather in the same building like we would a factory. We'll work factory shift hours. And like, if I see you here doing stuff, I'm assuming that's useful stuff. And if we need to be more productive, come early, stay late, right? I call that pseudo productivity. The techno story is that worked okay, not great, but worked okay until the front office IT revolution of the late 90s and early 2000s. And then once we threw network computers and then later mobile computing into the sort of office work sphere, pseudo productivity spun off the rails, right? Because the personal computer came in, and now suddenly the amount of different things you could work on, you know, quadrupled. No longer do we have specialists to type and specialists to handle communication. Like, the amount of work you could do quadrupled. Low friction communication networks made it really easy to ask people to do things. So workload skyrocketed. Email, chat really changed the game when it came to demonstrating visible effort. Now you could be doing this in an incredible fine granularity at a frenetic pace. How quickly I respond to a message might be really important signal in trying to show how pseudo productive I actually am. So my argument was, the front office IT revolution plus this older idea of pseudo productivity, they didn't mix. And it led to this increasing exhaustion of knowledge workers as the amount of stuff they're working on increased. the amount of their day dedicated to talking about work instead of actually doing work increased. The freneticism and speed of their work increased. At the same time, they were getting more nihilistic. Like, what am I actually doing here? I'm just doing all these visible signs of productivity. I'm sending emails, I'm in meetings, but I'm not actually writing the marketing report. I'm not actually programming the computer. And it led to the burnout epidemic. And so there's that underlying techno story of technology plus that crude metric didn't work well. So we have to reassess, what does it mean to produce really good stuff? Can we do that in a way that doesn't make work really exhausting? So I have that sort of personal angle. And then there's also this sort of deeper techno-social economic story. And they're both circling, I think, the same issues.
Hmm. Well, what did COVID do to this picture? I mean, you know, there's this profound change. I mean, again, this is, we're talking about knowledge workers almost by definition here, and perhaps you should bound that concept for us a little more. But the rise of remote work in the aftermath of COVID and the seeming durability of our commitment to that. I mean, there's just, you know, I guess many organizations are still struggling with just how to get the balance right. But there does seem to be this hybrid level of commitment to remote and in-office work for many organizations. And there are upsides and downsides to that, but it does change this, at least the optics of pseudo-productivity. I mean, you're just, if you're not seeing people, if you're not condemning people to have to be at their desk for 40 hours a week, whether that's the best use of their time or not, because so much of their time is now remote and you're not actually, you know, they don't get the credit for being at their desk because they're, you know, there is no desk to be at much of the time. And then there's this phenomenon of, you know, the quiet quitting that has been much discussed. How do you view what recent years, you know, during and post COVID have done to this conversation?
I think the beginning of COVID pushed this increasing issue people were having with the unsustainability of pseudo-productivity. It pushed it over the edge. Because a couple things happened when knowledge workers had to go remote right away. When we were shifting remote, we were already, for the most part, at our max capacity for the amount of work that we could have on our plate at the same time and have any chance of not drowning. And the reason why we're at max capacity is because in knowledge work, we leave workload management up to the individual. Like, for the most part, that's up to you to figure out how to manage what you're doing and what you say yes to. There's a lot of autonomy and ambiguity in knowledge work. So how a lot of people began to manage their workloads is they would wait until the stress of their workload got high enough that it outweighed their concern about the negative social costs of saying no to new work. Like, this became the primary governor mechanism by which so many knowledge workers manage their workloads. So of course, this keeps you at a state of having a stressfully large amount of work. If you have to be stressed before you begin to say no, everyone has a stressful amount of work. Then the pandemic hit, which automatically gave us like 25% more tasks overnight because we had to adjust unexpectedly to, oh, we got to run our company.
You had to wipe down your groceries.
Yeah. And just work itself. Like, how do we deliver our services? You know, if I remember this going on at the New Yorker, like, how do we move our whole production process to like a digital pipeline? It was just new work came out of nowhere. The collaboration then also became less efficient because we lost all of the, oh, I see your office door is open. So I'll poke my head in and be like, hey, well, what are we going to do about this client? And it takes 2 minutes. Instead, we had to start scheduling Zoom meetings. But the smallest granularity of these meetings was a half hour because it's hard to drag anything smaller on your calendar. And so now we were making the collaboration, the overhead related to work, that became a lot less efficient. And then finally, to compensate for the fact that I can't see you doing visible activity, we just moved this over to being even more frenetic with digital communication. Like, it really now is important for me not to reply quickly. Like, I have to reply very quickly to Slack because, like, this is maybe the only way I have right now to demonstrate that I'm being pseudo productive, right? Mm-hmm. So all these things happened overnight, and people just said enough is enough. And I actually argue, this is a piece I wrote a couple months ago. I argued that many of these sort of spasmodic, emergent grassroots revolution reform movements and work that we saw throughout the pandemic period were in part people responding in a primal way to this. I've been pushed over the edge with what's going on in knowledge work. So I think the knowledge work component of the Great Resignation was a response to people saying enough is enough. I think quiet quitting was a response for the younger generation who couldn't resign or switch down the half hours and move to a cabin. So quiet quitting was a response. I think much of the fury around the remote work wars that really picked up steam in 2021 and 2022 was also a sort of misguided response to this deeper primal rejection of work has just become sort of intolerably frenetic and overloaded, and I'm getting actually almost no real work done. Objectively, the remote work wars didn't make a ton of sense, right? You had this thing that did not exist 16 months earlier, and now you had worker groups talking about it like it was the Geneva Convention. It was this like fundamental right that of course work is supposed to happen at home. How could we ever take this away? This didn't even exist, you know, 16 months earlier. I think part of that was just a generalized zeal for reform, because when we took this already sort of exhausting tempo and this nihilism of all we do is talk about work and rarely get work done, when we pushed that over the edge in the pandemic, it broke a lot of people. And a lot of the unrest we saw in the knowledge work sector throughout the pandemic, I think, was people just responding to enough is enough, but they didn't really know exactly what they were responding to. And I think a lot of those efforts were sort of misguided energy. And we missed a lot of the opportunities we had to really make better reform here. That's the context in which I was thinking about slow productivity.
Well, let's talk about the principles of achieving slow productivity. What is signified by the phrase? And you frame your discussion around many interesting case studies, the main being John McPhee, but you talk about Benjamin Franklin and Jane Austen and a bunch of scientists, and it's all... It does suggest, I mean, that this is really your thesis. You talk about the ways in which our engagement with new information technology has you know, deranged our sense of what it is to be productive and how we measure success. And so if you go far enough back in time, it's not a surprise that you see examples of people who didn't have this technology who were succeeding by the lights of history in spectacular ways at a very different cadence with respect to how they worked. You know, feel free to bring up any of the principal case studies you want, but we should talk about your three stages here: do fewer things, work at a natural pace, and obsess over quality.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason, I mean, because it was a big decision, but the reason I chose to use as the primary case studies these sort of historical figures, there's really two aspects to that I think is important to sort of set the stage. One, I was wary of the uncanny valley effect. I've seen this a lot when talking about sort of contemporary work. There's an uncanny valley effect. If you say, look, I'm going to tell you about a company that exists right now that's doing things differently, or a specific employee at a marketing company, and here's how they do things differently. Their job is so similar to yours that the differences really begin to matter, right? And people have a hard time getting past like, oh, but that's a client service firm, and our client, we have a timesheet firm. And it's actually, I've found that it's difficult for people to get past that uncanny valley. It's too close. If it's too close to what they do, but not exactly what they do, it becomes an unbridgeable or a disorienting gap. So I said, why don't I look at what I call traditional knowledge workers, who are actually defined by, like, this could be the critique, but I'm twisting the critique to be a benefit. They're defined by all the freedom and autonomy they had to experiment with what's the best way to create value using my brain. I said, this is why these people are important, because they had all the freedom in the world to figure out what works. So if we look at what they settled on, they're probably uncovering some useful universal principles about the best way of creating valuable things using the human brain. Now, what we could then do is, once we isolate those principles, I can do the hard work of, okay, so how can we make that relevant to someone who works in a cubicle? How can we make that relevant to an entrepreneur in 2024? Yeah, there's a lot of work then to translate those principles to tactical things that make sense to people today. But I thought that was the right way to do it. So those three principles you mentioned were the three big things that came up if you study historically people who were good with creating valuable things with their brain. They didn't work on too many things at the same time. They really avoided overload. Their pace was varied, hard periods, less hard periods. Also, they would measure productivity on very large time scales. So many of the most productive people in history, if you go back and look at a random month in their life, they seem incredibly non-productive, right? Because they didn't think about productivity in terms of like today needs to be productive. They thought about it like the next 10 years, I want to produce something that matters. And then finally, they cared a lot about craft, right? That was a sort of antidote to the appeal of busyness. was to instead reorient their interest towards, I want to do something really well and I want to keep better at what I'm doing. All three of those principles, I argue, can be first adapted to modern knowledge workers with a lot of freedom, and then can be further adapted even to knowledge workers who are in a situation where they have less freedom. We can get ideas from there that transmute into interesting, tangible advice for people in various situations in our current moment.
The purest case is the person who really is his or her own boss and can just decide to create whatever they want, and then the analogy to the historical people who fully embraced this art that has been lost, you know, someone like Ben Franklin, it's fairly direct. But then there are the cases of people who are working inside organizations where they're being managed by somebody who has certain expectations, and you're teaching them to how to implement certain of these principles within the constraints of being in an organization that, you know, where they can't reinvent all the processes that they have to engage.
Yeah, like we can, let's walk through that chain with one example, right? So let's start with like a historical case study from the book, one I really enjoyed uncovering, which was about Jane Austen, because there used to be this mythology around Jane Austen, this oft-repeated story that she would write surreptitiously in between all the different obligations she had. And there was this very specific story about how there was a creak in the door to their parlor. And this was really important because when she heard the door creak, she could hide her writing. She could hide it right away before the announced visitor walked in the room. And this has been repeated a lot. Virginia Woolf wrote about this in a room of one's own. But it turns out that this was a story that Jane Austen's nephew invented after Jane was long dead, in a sort of gauzy Victorian biography he wrote. Mm. But if you go back to the primary sources on Austen, and I read a couple really good biographies that went back to the primary sources, it turns out that's not at all how Jane Austen produced her books. In fact, the busyness of her life made it impossible for her to write. And she was very frustrated about this, right? There was a sort of temporary reprieve from busyness when she was younger and she started some books, and then for over a decade just couldn't make progress and was very frustrated. Eventually, after her father died, her and her mom and her sister and a family friend said, enough is enough. Like, we need to disconnect from the world. And they moved into this cottage that was on land. It was owned by their brother who had inherited this big estate. And they stopped socializing. They stopped doing the sort of Jane Austen book type life. And her mom started like dressing like a laborer and just working in the garden. And Jane had very little to do. And she wrote 5 books in like 7 years. Like, that's when all of her books were written. And then she died. And so like the real story of Jane Austen was she couldn't really do anything great until she could simplify what she was working on, right? Her story was not how do you fit in work in between a busy schedule, right? So this is like at the core of this idea of doing fewer things. Okay. If we want to apply this first in the modern context to like an entrepreneur, right? Like someone who's, look, I run my own thing. The lesson here is really clear. It's this sort of Steve Martin type, be so good they can't ignore you. Don't fall into the trap of having too many irons in the fire. Don't have 7 different projects that's going on. Simplify, simplify, simplify. Figure out what you do best and really focus on that. Because if you have too many things going on, you're not going to be able to do anything great. And what matters is the thing you do great. Then we further bring this to, okay, what if I work at a company and I have like a boss that like gives me things to do? Well, we can still put that idea into effect by saying, okay, if you can't just say no to a lot of things, what you can do is take your list of things you have to do and split it into 2 categories, actively working on and waiting to work on next. And you have 2 or 3 things that you're actively working on, and everything else is in like an ordered queue. And every time you finish something you're actively working on, you pull the next thing off the waiting for list and say, okay, this is being added to the active category. You can actually make this visible. This is you can make it a shared document. Like, your boss knows all about this. Like, yes, boss, great. Let's definitely get this done. I'm your man, right? Okay, I'm going to put it right here on my list. You can check in anytime you want. You'll see exactly its status. And as soon as it makes it to the active list, it's going to get my full attention. I'll let you know right away. We can have meetings. We can check in 5 times a day, and that thing's going to get done, right? So you've still engineered, in this final scenario, you've still engineered a setup where the number of things you're actively working on is still pretty small, which is the key. But you're doing it in the constraints of, I have a lot of work coming my way. I don't have a lot of say over what I say yes or no to. And so we can start from Jane Austen, isolate that principle, and then just adapt it from, you know, starting with the like Tim Ferriss show listener who has their own thing and can control every part of their life, and
but then move on to the person who, you know, I'm in my fourth year of this job and my boss is always like asking me to do things. The same principle can be adapted to all these situations.
Yeah, although what's required there, it seems to me, is a little bit of finesse in how you manage up, because you're now communicating with your boss, your own kind of user interface needs, right? Like this is how you need to work with me, your employee, and you're basically like, if your boss comes to you with one task, you know, get this done, you say, sure, this is now my priority, and then he comes to you with the next task, get this done before the first one's done. It's now on you to say, well, okay, yes, you have me doing task A, now you want task B, now I need guidance from you, does task B supersede task A? And you're sort of managing, you know, you're creating a structure and kind of training your boss to interface with it in a way that works.
Yeah, and here's the key about that, right? You have to understand, what is the problem I'm solving for my boss, right? And, you know, typically the problem in this situation you're solving for a boss is that this, whatever this task is, it came into their world. It's a source of stress. Like, this thing needs to be done and I have to make sure it gets done. So it's a source of stress. The problem you're solving for the boss is making that stress go away, right? Mm. So one way you can solve it is, you know, if you're disorganized or if you're just off, they don't know, you're a black box. I don't know how you organize your work. If I give you something to do, I would rather you just do it right away, not because it needs to be done right away, not because I like getting quick email responses, but because I don't know what's going to happen with this once I give it to you. So I have to keep track of it mentally until it's done. I don't want to keep track of it mentally too long. So I'm just going to pest you, get this done, get this done, get this done. Mm. If you have an alternative thing that they see, oh, here it is, boom, it's on the public Trello board, I can watch it march up, you've solved the boss's problem a different way. I don't have to worry about this, right? Cal is on it. He has this system. He's not asking me to do more work. He's just giving me transparency into how he manages his work. I don't need this done tomorrow, but the key thing is I don't have to worry about this getting done because it's in the system. It's going to march up. In a few days, he'll get to it. I can check in on this anytime I want. Great. You've taken this stress out of my life. So if you're solving your boss's problem, they'll leave you alone. And so I think we, in a lot of cases, we assume what our bosses want is stuff done right away and stuff done very quickly because they're, you know, late stage capitalists and just don't like us and want to exploit us or whatever. But they don't care about that. They care about make my stress go away. And if I can, if I know how you're going to do this, I don't really care that you have this like dual category list. In fact, you probably are going to get brownie points for me because you seem like you've got your act together. Whereas, you know, someone over here, they're always like frantically emailing and forgetting things. I'm always having to remind them. So I think we have, it's the double-edged sword of knowledge work autonomy, right? We don't have set systems for here's how we manage our work. Here's how we collaborate. Here's how we manage our workloads. That's left up to the individual. So the sharp edge of that sword is that this allows you, if you're not careful, to get completely overloaded because, hey, you manage your own work. And if you say yes to everything and just jump on a lot of calls, you can get overloaded. But the other side of that sword is you can leverage that autonomy to say, here's how I'm going to do this. And you can find a way to do it that's going to be better. So I think what, like 7 or 8 bosses out of 10, something like this, if done tactfully, I give like 3 or 4 different ways of doing this. You can kind of massage the different situation. Mm. 7 or 8 bosses out of 10, this will work. 2 bosses out of 10 are just bad bosses. And unfortunately, that's a problem that's unsolvable except for by moving jobs. But I feel like I didn't invent that problem. And you're going to have that problem whether you're doing these ideas or not.
Yeah. And what you're describing does map onto my experience of being a boss. If something has to be done right away, if it is some kind of emergency, well, then it's understandable that it supersedes the other stuff that is on everyone's plate and that gets communicated. And then I'm not surprised when the other stuff comes later because I just had everyone respond to an emergency. But if it's not an emergency, then really the only concern is that there's enough conscientiousness on the part of the employee that once I hand it off, I know it's eventually going to get done, right? I mean, that you've taken my stress away. And so it's just not having to keep track of it, knowing that it's not going to fall through the cracks is really it's mission accomplished.
Right. And then there's this. So let's think about what advantages accrue in this situation, right? Because one of the effects I talk about is when you agree to do something and you're actively working on it, you're going to accrue administrative overhead, right? If I agree to do something, I'm working on it, there's emails to be sent, there's meetings to be had, right? This is actually, I think, one of the biggest drivers of the exhaustion in knowledge work right now is that when we agree to too many things and actively work on too many things, all of that administrative overhead aggregates. And we pass this point pretty soon where most of our day is either spent talking about work or I'm within, mm-hmm. 5 or 6 minutes of having to check on something related to work. This is neurologically exhausting. Our brain can't switch context this fast. By 2 o'clock, we're just sort of done. And also it's very inefficient. We can't actually get good stuff done in this setting, right? If you say, no, I'm only working actively on these two things. I've agreed to do all these things and I'll do them, but I'm going to actively work on these two things. You're only generating administrative overhead from two things. So that's drastically improved your day-to-day experience. So your subjective well-being is going to be much, much better because your whole day is now not fragmented. But if we zoom out a little bit and look at the rate at which things are completed from this list, that's going to go up as well because now most of your day is focused on the work and not talking about the work. So the rate, the average, whatever, average time per completion per task actually goes up. So then you get this secondary benefit of your boss begins to notice you're shipping stuff much faster than anyone else. Like when I zoom out on this last quarter, look at all these things you got done at a high level of quality. And at this point, now you have the flywheel turning and everyone's on board. So there's a profoundly positive effect that can come from just that first idea of I'm just reducing how many things I'm actively working on at once. And so it's not accomplish fewer things. It's work on fewer things at once. And those are actually two really different ideas.
Yeah. How does this interact with people's concern around procrastination? And because as you say, it can sound like doing fewer things can sound like being less ambitious, right? Or and being, you have some specific advice, which is or seems to run counter to other advice I think everyone has absorbed, which is, that there's this common understanding that I forget which productivity guru gave us this phrase, but it's just, the time it takes to do something kind of expands to fill the deadline, right? So whatever you set the deadline, that's how long it's going to take to do that thing. And that seems to suggest that you could set, narrower and narrower deadlines and get more stuff done, right? Be more aggressive with your deadlines. But in the book, you basically tell people to just double the length of their deadlines. If they think it's going to take 2 weeks, just give yourself a month. How does that not just become a contract with oneself to be lazy and not care about it?
Well, give yourself a month instead of 2 weeks, but don't give yourself 6 months, right? So in other words, one of the things I realized when thinking about this question of I want to do good stuff, but I don't want work to completely take over my life is when you actually go slower. So I'm going to, instead of saying I'm going to write this book chapter in a month, I'm going to do it in 2 months. Everything else sort of falls into place. Like when you have breathing room to get something done, like a reasonable amount of breathing room, getting it done becomes less onerous and you do better work, right? Because what happens is when we set timelines, what we tend to do is just say, what's the best case scenario? And then we get really excited about imagining a future in which that best case scenario comes true. And then we get connected to that. So we think like, man, if I could finish this book chapter in a month, that'd be great. Wow, I would love that. If I was done before the break, that would make all these other things work. We fall in love with this story of what we want to be true. And then of course we can't get it done that quick because it was unrealistic. And then it backs into other things and things pile up and we get exhausted. And so just taking more time to do things, not endless time, not open-ended time. We're still in a world of I'm making commitments. I'm telling my editor when this is going to be done. I'm telling my boss, yes, I'll do this. Here's when to expect it. So we're still in a world of commitments we have to honor. We're just making those commitments more reasonable. And that's one of the big things I personally went through, right? Thinking about slow productivity was if you zoom out and say, what I care about is like what I do this decade, then you realize I could slow down the pace I'm working on each of these things because I have a lot of time to get these things done. And if this book takes me 2 years instead of 14 months, doesn't matter at the big scale, but it could make a huge difference in terms of like what the day-to-day experience of my life is. So this idea of just slow down, take more time, don't try to work at the most optimistic possible time assessment for each thing you do. Psychologically, that makes a big difference.
What is the role of money here? I guess this question is more pitched to the entrepreneur or the person who can decide to spend money or not to achieve this goal of doing fewer things and working at a natural pace and obsessing over quality, which implicit in obsessing over quality is that you're doing the thing you're best at as opposed to doing a bunch of things that where you're really not the best person to be doing those tasks. how do you think about spending money to, you know, leverage other people's time so that you're really just doing what you should be doing?
Well, it's not just, yeah, that's part of it, right? Yes, you could be spending more money to take more things off your plate. You also should be considering, when possible, just giving up money by doing fewer things to give you more breathing room, right? You know, I profiled this entrepreneur who decided at some point, I'm going to take the summers off. And like, she did the math. It's like 20% less income. And she's like, I could make that work, right? Because I was making half of this 3 years ago. Like, my, you know, income changes a lot for entrepreneurs. So what if, instead of just trying to optimize the total amount of dollars I make, I said, I can make a reasonable number of dollars and not work in July and August. And then I can go off and do, she was really into like yoga and recharging. Fantastic. That's a great option, you know? So just thinking about if the goal is not optimizing every dollar, but making a reasonable amount of dollars combined with a very reasonable life, that puts a lot of things on the table as well, right? And so that helps with entrepreneurs, because I think there's definitely a mindset of, I want every option on the table. You know, what if this thing stops working? I want to have another backup option. I mean, I fell prey to this early in the pandemic. I went through this sort of moment of economic fear, where it was, what if universities go away? What if publishing goes away, right? Because there are signs, like the universities were freezing salary. The publishers were changing their advance arrangements. It was like, really, like, what's going to happen? And I became a lot more entrepreneurial, you know? And I was in that mindset of, I need various irons in the fire, because who knows like what the economy is going to do. And then it took me 2 years to unwind most of that again and say, okay, let me take those irons back out of the fire. I don't need all of that money. What I need to figure out is like a life where I'm producing stuff that I'm really proud of, and I can easily like support my family and feel good about it. And it's just a different objective than just, I want the number on the scoreboard to be as high as possible.
Yeah. Well, this does bring us back to the fundamental question of what a good life actually is. And, you know, as I said, there's a certain level of privilege assumed for the purpose of this conversation. But when we look at, you know, what a successful civilization will produce for more and more of us, you know, more of the time, it is a picture of privilege, especially in the knowledge workspace. If you think about what the successful implementation of AI will be, if we ever get there without destroying ourselves, it will be a kind of post-scarcity world. And so, I mean, like what would a post-scarcity world look like? And, you know, what would it mean for everyone to essentially retire early, or be free to retire early? I mean, what is leisure good for? And what is it to have a mind that is capable of getting the best out of leisure? Many people predict that without the necessity of work, without people having to figure out how to spend, you know, 40 hours a week producing something that other people will pay them for so that they can survive, in a world of sufficient abundance where your claim on existence need not be anchored to your doing productive work, and rather there's just enough wealth to go around. And now the question is, what do you want to do with your life? Many people are anticipating a real crisis of meaning. And many of the arguments against things like universal basic income, even if we could afford to spread the wealth around, people say, well, that would be disastrous, because people just would become suicidally depressed, not being forced to work in a job they don't like to get to weekends so that they can be relieved they're no longer working. How do you think about this? Are you worried about a crisis of meaning if we were all doing fewer things at a natural pace, at a high quality, and had more leisure time? Does that put you in mind to worry about some sort of dystopian revelation at the end of all that?
Well, I think for my audience, which tends to be like college-educated knowledge workers, we already are facing this problem. We already face this problem. I think modern knowledge work, especially in sort of like highly developed countries like the US, is a sort of lightweight version of this post-scarcity sort of utopia, right? Mm. I mean, if you are, early 20th century working in a factory, or, late 19th century working in like a Ebenezer Scrooge counting house or something like this, right? You would look at the jobs today and say, well, wait a second. You have full autonomy. You're like on email, and like people kind of send you stuff, and you decide what you want to work on, and you're like in an air-conditioned office. And actually now you're at your house most of the time anyways. There's no board where people are writing how many widgets you produce. No one's measuring anything. There's no Winslow Taylor character with a stopwatch trying to like see if you're doing things so efficiently. You have hours where like you could just sort of disappear. Like this, these jobs are you know, half a job, a quarter of a job. This is like a miracle, right? And how did we react to that is I think it made us uncomfortable. And so pseudo productivity filled that void. And it was, instead of this is great, we can have the like sort of John Kenneth Galbraith prediction of let me just work 3 hard hours and then go to the golf course. Mm-hmm. We filled our days with like empty calories of frenetic activity, like email going back and forth. We're going to jump back and forth on these meetings. We're not going to actually engage seriously with how we structure our work or how we collaborate, because actually there is a sort of masochistic comfort in just like, I'm busy all the time doing stuff, you know? So I think we already see how we reacted to it. And in some sense, slow productivity is saying, even right now, before we need an AI-fueled even further utopia, we could be taking these jobs. That, I mean, this is such a, everyone in the history of the world, including monarchs of the grandest empires, would love to be a marketing associate, you know, at a mid-level K Street firm in Washington, D.C. Like that is like the ultimate existence. Are you kidding me? And so even right now, I'm trying to argue we could make our lives better. Like, what do we need to do? Well, we need to focus more on craft. We need to stop being so busy because we're not wired for that. That's exhausting us. We need to work on a smaller number of things that are really valuable. Humans love to see their intentions made manifest concretely in the world where, you know, this is what differentiates us from animals. We get bored, and that negative physiological state is alleviated through the creation of newness, right? So like, we need to express our humanness, like build things we can point to and say, this is valuable. People respect this. And so even right now, before we have any of these sort of future transformations, we could be making these particular types of jobs that I happen to write about. We could be making them much better with something like slow productivity or something different, but whatever is not just like pseudo productivity. So I think, you know, the way we work in these like super lucky jobs in the 21st century shows that, yeah, we do have a hard time with this. Isn't just grueling. You have a lot of freedom. You have a lot you could or couldn't do here. You have a lot of control here. We didn't like that freedom. And so we sort of fell back into that masochistic comfort of like, I'm just going to feel more better to be exhausted. There's no factory foreman exhausting me, so I'll do it with Microsoft Outlook on my own. And so I think we can learn something interesting about what's happening right now about our unfamiliarity or self-reflection or self-interrogation on what do we want work to be and how do we want this to integrate into our life? We don't even know what we want when like we're the dog on the track and we actually catch the rabbit.
Mm. But so catching the rabbit in this case would be to be able to use your time precisely as you want to and have that be good enough. There's no real carrot and stick required to get you to move through your day. You're free to just, you know, for some of us, our lives have begun to resemble that because we're just incredibly lucky. But in the case of now we're talking about, you know, some utopian vision of fundamental non-scarcity. In the case of that being realized, people would be free to do whatever they wanted, you know, within the constraints of, you know, not screwing up the opportunities for happiness of their neighbors, right? So you'd be free to, you know, learn the guitar or play frisbee on the beach. And yet we're, you know, what I'm detecting in the culture is a pervasive anxiety that we're not up to that, right? You're going to confront a generation of profoundly unhappy, unfulfilled, and increasingly malevolent people. Like you give people that kind of freedom and they're going to find some, you know, horrible way to undermine not only their opportunities, but the opportunities of others. I mean, that seems to be, I mean, there's a kind of a Calvinistic, you know, religious version of this concern, but I'm always surprised to hear that people are worried that, that on some level, getting everything we want and could want is a disaster in the making. And that intuitively, I see how that could happen for some people, but you know, many of us have figured out how to be happy just sitting alone in a room, right? That's the essence of what, you know, meditation is, for instance. I mean, because once you figured out how to be happy just looking at the sky, then it's not a mystery how you would be happy in a world where there was such abundance, there was no longer any cultural judgment that you should be using your time in any other way as to produce more happiness for yourself and those you love, right? So like the fact that you're having a picnic with your family on a Monday afternoon, there'd be no judgment with that. That's just obviously what you should be doing. People predict just, you know, psychological disaster under those conditions. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't even know that thinking about time spent working and time spent not working is even the right metric to think about here.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's easier than that. Right. I mean, so what humans want in work is they want autonomy. They want a sense of what they're doing is important, and they want freedom from just explicit negative physiological effects. Right. Like, I don't want to actually be in a condition that makes me feel literally bad. So a big problem with knowledge work right now is you could have autonomy, but this being overloaded, having too much to do, having the administrative overhead take over most of your day, constantly falling behind work, this actually creates like a highly negative physiological experience of work. Our brains exhaust ourselves. It's nihilistic. So if you get rid of that and say, I work on fewer things, but I do those things really well. I have some autonomy in choosing what I'm working on, but I have pride in my craft and the things I do seem to have an impact, right? You could do that 8 hours a day. You could do that 10 hours a day. It's not really about the amount of time, but the freedom of that negative physiological effect plus mastery plus autonomy. I mean, we know this from like self-determination theory makes people happy, right? So it seems so simple, but then sometimes when I come to talk about this, it feels like the allegory of Plato's cave, you know, like I'm coming into the cave and I'm like these shadows, which in this world is like all the email and all this overload going back and forth. Like, this is not really what work is, right? Like, this is like a sort of a simulacrum of work or something like that. But really what I saw outside is like work is I produce these things and I can point to a thing I produce and it's valuable. And if I get better at it, I get rewarded more. And I have some autonomy on this. I don't feel bad all day long. That's what work is. And it's like they don't trust what I'm trying to say, right? So I almost think it's like simpler. It doesn't have to be work has been reduced to almost nothing. I just like make work. These knowledge jobs don't have to be painful, right? Like factory jobs are painful because it's very unnatural for humans to sit and do the same physical repetitive thing all day long. That's why we had to invent labor unions. That's why we had to invent massive regulatory frameworks, because humans weren't meant to do that. It's just, it's intrinsic. So it's an entire zero-sum dynamic between the workers and management. They need you to do something that is not going to be pleasant. And you're like, well, you better give me enough in return because this is not pleasant, right? Knowledge work actually doesn't have that same dynamic. I mean, those who are fortunate enough to be college-educated knowledge workers, a lot of what makes those jobs exhausting right now is unforced errors. Hmm. It's like it doesn't have to be that way. The stuff that's making you exhausted is not producing value for the company. The overload and having most of your day be administrative overhead, this doesn't make your marketing firm more profitable. This doesn't make your software firm produce better software. It doesn't really help anyone. It's you just don't realize these shadows aren't what work really is. And so I have this much more proximate utopian vision, which is also a much more watered down utopian vision, but it's just making these jobs that like we should be so proud we existed. We created this huge economic sector because we generated so much wealth in the world that this is possible, that we can have 40% of US economic activity be dedicated to this sort of like potentially awesome sector. And we just made it terrible in a way that it didn't have to be. So just like making it less terrible is a sort of not a utopia, but like I think it would be a lot better. And I think it's like very doable if we could just get people to turn around and look out the cave entrance.
Yeah, I guess my vantage point on these questions is fairly distorted by having won some kind of lottery here, because, you know, the truth is I'm essentially a workaholic, because my work is in the Venn diagram of work and you know what I want to do, just intrinsically. You know, it's like something like 90% overlap at this point. It's just crazy. It's like I wanted to read your book. I wanted to have this conversation with you. Doing both of those things is my quote work. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's just an amazing privilege to be able to do this. And so it doesn't feel like work. And so, but because of that, there's no boundary between my work and the rest of my life. So there's no natural stopping point in my day. I mean, I'm always reading something that I want to read, and or, you know, listening to an audiobook or a podcast. I'm getting in information. I'm doing these things for my work, but it's because I, you know, what's capturing my attention is what I want to pay attention to, again, 90% of the time. And that bleeds over into my weekends and into nights. So, you know, then I have to decide. Then I'm forced to look in the mirror of my priorities and decide, well, you know, you say that spending time with your family is really one of your high priorities. But look at you over there, you know, reading a book or deciding to, you know, do something that is by definition not spending time with your family. And so you're just, I feel like I'm living out this utopian vision earlier than most people, where I'm forced to confront, well, what would you do if all of your time was discretionary, right? And, you know, how much Frisbee would you play and how much time would you actually spend with your kids? And some of the answers are not necessarily flattering, right? I mean, there's a kind of compulsiveness to even to my pleasant engagement with work, you know, and there can be a work-life balance question that emerges even when the wolf is not at the door and nobody's forcing me to do anything. I'm just wondering what you know, if there's any general lessons to draw from this, because I do think we have to get this part right. We have to anticipate what success looks like for more and more people more of the time and figure out how to live meaningful lives when there really is a tremendous amount of freedom to just spend time as you see fit. I mean, because again, that's what winning this game will look like economically for people. And I just detect in the culture a profound skepticism around our succeeding at that.
Well, I mean, I think this gets to one of the core disagreements I have, for example, with the ascendant anti-work movement, right? So I think there's been varied reactions to this commonly felt phenomenon of the last couple decades of knowledge workers just getting exhausted and burnt out. One of the big recent reactions is really this anti-productivity or anti-work movement, where really you have this core idea of let's reach back and apply not like postmodern leftist thinking, but much more like early 20th century modernist, sort of Marxist influenced left-wing thinking. A lot of this was inspired by, for example, Ginny O'Dell, who trained under a very well-known sort of Italian communist, right? So she was bringing in at a time when sort of postmodern left critiques have become dominant in many parts of our culture, she injected a much more traditional, classical, economic, sort of modernist critique. And so we have this sort of like blast from the early 20th century past in this conversation. But a big core of this movement is saying work itself, the desire to work, this is all constructed. It's a cultural construction. It's part of the superstructure and sort of base superstructure theory to just keep the proletariat exploitable by the owners of capital.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of like classic, like early critical theorist, you know, Frankfurt School style critique that's very popular now, that like work is a construction. And these books have titles like How to Do Nothing, you know, Do Nothing, right? So it's really sort of pushing this idea of like, if we could just escape this sort of this opiate, this constructed culture that work is good, which is all just about, you know, late stage capitalism trying to keep us, you know, whatever, tied to our sort of exploitative positions. The big problem with that approach is it sort of denies the fundamental human drive to actually want to produce things and work, right? So I do agree with you. I think a reasonable, authentic engagement with the problem of what's wrong with work, but also then what should work be like, has to start from this place that people do like to do things, right? And that goes back to my sort of watered down utopian vision. It's not necessarily, I think your situation is way more rarefied. The sort of those Venn diagrams overlap. I mean, I think for a lot of people, the Venn diagrams don't have to overlap like that, but it's just, I have work I do where I'm good at it. I have autonomy and it's not physiologically negative. And I do it for like a reasonable amount of time during the day. And then I go off and do other things. I know a lot of people like this. I like my work. I'm good at my work. I also really love surfing and mountain biking. And so I go to work an hour early, I get out of work at 4 so I can, you know, also mountain bike for an hour or whatever it is, right? I mean, I think it's, the vision could be something like that. But I think any engagement with this issue does have to take into account, and the anti-work movement doesn't, that work itself is not a construction. And we know this in part because the main proponents of this philosophy work really hard. I mean, they're writing books about this at a regular rate. They're trying to get their Substack subscribers up. They're getting on the bestseller list. They're promoting the books. And so they clearly feel an intrinsic need to try to produce something that matters in the world. And so I think that does have to be a big part of the engagement. We want to work and we're going to want to work, but what does that mean? And what should the boundaries be on that? And how do we figure that out? I mean, I agree with you. Those are the big questions. My frustration is we're already there for a big swath of our economy. We could be there. These knowledge jobs and like an age of hybrid, like we're here. We have all the pieces in place for like a revolutionary, substantial improvement of work for like huge swaths of people. And we have unforced errors. We're refusing to interrogate the realities of the structures of our work and are just sort of assuming like, this is just what work is. Like, yeah, we're just supposed to be on email and overloaded. And this is just work. There's such a lack of curiosity in knowledge work in terms of just thinking, how does this work unfold and why does it unfold that way? There's just a lack of curiosity that's, you know, I want to be having the debate you're talking about. And yet we're not there because we're burning ourselves out when we don't need to be.
But I agree with you that people want to work in some ways intrinsically, but what would constitute, I mean, they want to do things that are appreciated. I mean, that's just, value that interaction with other people. But in a condition of perfect abundance, that could take many different forms that are, you know, many of which wouldn't look like traditional work. I mean, what I don't think would happen is, I don't think everyone would be content. And I think this is the fear that everyone is just going to be a full-time consumer, right? And under conditions where they're either there'd be less to consume of less quality, or it's just all going to be, you know, AI generated content, right? So we're just going to be in some Aldous Huxley dystopia, and people just will watch, you know, an endless, you know, their queue on Netflix will be endless, and it will be mostly AI generated, and we'll just entertain ourselves to death. But I share your conviction that most people, virtually all people in a anything like a well-adjusted society, would value interacting with others in ways that others appreciate and just produce things that, you know, that are worth paying attention to. And I mean, that's everything from, you know, throwing a great dinner party to actually doing classic entrepreneurial work where you create the next thing that other people desperately want to buy. But I do, I just think it's more and more we have to envision what real success would look like and what the ethical and political and economic norms would be that would allow us to spread the wealth around. I mean, at the moment, like when you have a conversation about universal basic income, you immediately crash into people's negative assumptions here, which is, well, one, it would be, if you just handed people money, they would just become drug addicts and watch television and it would just be a disaster. Two, they don't deserve that money, right? Even if they were going to use it profitably in a way that wouldn't embarrass us, there's some violation of core ethics to just hand out money for nothing, right? There's something intrinsically noble about having to work so as to secure your purchase on life. And those two assumptions go uninspected for long enough that we just never even think of what a world will look like when there really is enough wealth to go around, again, in success. But yeah, it's just interesting to consider. I mean, I guess we have several uncanny valley problems that await us as we move toward that space.
Right. I'll say my predictions right now, and these vary, but like when I'm thinking ahead, where are we going to be delivered with technological developments, maybe on the decade scale? I'm often considered to be more of an incrementalist on this than a lot of other people, but there's two things I think will happen that are maybe not as drastic as perhaps what you're envisioning. Like with AI, for example, you know, I think where we're potentially going to see the large economic transformation is less about large sectors of the economy disappearing. Where I really think we're going to see the large transformation is in knowledge work in particular. If right now we're spending 90% of our cognitive cycles either tending to administrative overhead or recovering from tending to administrative overhead, what happens when AI can take the bulk of that off our plates? Now, what the response is going to be, we're going to have a lot of cognitive surplus. Right, so we're going to have in the work context a sudden surplus of structured, compensated thought. Like we have a brain that now has extra time; it can think about things and try to add value to information. What I think we're going to see is a huge expansion of where we can think of knowledge, work, cognition being spread into other parts of people's lives and other parts of just the day-to-day operation of our world. Right, that's part of what we're going to do with this cognitive surplus. It's going to invent. The notion of like where we apply brain work is going to greatly expand. I mean, for example, like the number of households that are just going to have sort of on demand, like human brains that can be involved in like managing the details of the household, or the number of small businesses where there's these things they couldn't even think about before trying to optimize or do or add to their business. There's going to be sort of brain cycles on tap that they can tap into. It's this, this view I have that it's less that artificial intelligence is going to take over or add all this intelligence to all the stuff we do, so much as it's going to unlock a lot of surplus intelligence, which is going to need places to go. And we're going to much prefer the surplus intelligence of a human than trying to get an AI bot just right to sort of manage my whatever's happening at my company. I'd much rather have a human come and do this, and they're going to have extra cycles. So I think that's going to be a change. It's going to vastly expand the variety of economic cognitive activity. The other thing that's going to happen on the near future timeline, I think, and it's going to be helpful for these utopian visions, is we're going to figure out remote work, how to do that right, which is a topic I wrote a lot about for The New Yorker during the pandemic, and we're not doing it right now. But I do think we are evolving more competency with having people be physically non-located. As that evolves, it really is, as we solve this problem of scarcity of real estate in a small number of areas, I think that's going to open up a lot of interesting opportunities, because we are going to have lower cost of living in places that people want to live.
Mm.
Just by vastly expanding where like a college-educated knowledge worker might work, and you can self-sort into all sorts of different interesting configurations that are life-affirming or interest-affirming. And it's going to be much cheaper, just because we're dealing with the denominator here of the amount of land is just much bigger.
Yeah.
That's going to play a big role too. So I'm much more of a thinker. I'm less on board with the sort of, not super intelligence, I know that's way farther, but this idea of sort of like just vast jobs are going to disappear, industries are going to disappear, and we're going to need UBI. The reconfiguration, I think, is more likely is going to be a vast increase in compensated cognitive activity and a notable decrease in cost of living and ability to self-sort your regional presence into something that affirms things you care about. And those are going to be very meaningful changes, I think, for the knowledge work landscape.
All right. I will take that near-term utopia if we can get it. That sounds like a target worth aiming at. Well, Cal, it's always great to speak with you. Once again, I'll remind people the book is Slow Productivity, and we have not covered all that is of interest in it. There's a fascinating footnote about how Galileo almost died by breathing noxious vapors from a cave that was working to cool the house he was staying in. That fairly blew my mind. I hadn't heard that story. But thank you for your work, Cal. It's really, it just offers great perspective on what so many of us are just mindlessly doing. I encourage you to keep going, whether you need to be compensated for this labor or not.
Well, thanks, Sam. And yeah, hopefully in the near future, I'll be doing so from some utopian location that's affirming my life values as AI-freed cognition is taking care of things. And oh, God knows who else.
We're going to be watching to see if we can detect when AI is writing your New Yorker articles for you.
Yeah. Okay.
That'll be the moment.
I'm not going to tell you. You have to try to guess. Yeah, exactly.
I won't send you an email at that moment.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not going to answer. All right. Well, Sam, I always appreciate it.